Hi, everybody. It's Jim Bakei. The podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. And in my continuing desire to help people through this process and help people through life, and having people that I think are quite extraordinary and really do live the moniker of Be You, The World Will Adjust, I'm happy to have Charles Fitzsimmons on the show today with me. Charles is a PhD in sports psychology from Western University. He's the founder and mental coach at Ellipse Performance. He's the mental coach for Golf Ontario, Fanshawe College, Alderton Elite Skating School, and the head coach for the Western University women's golf team since 2019. He's also an incredibly accomplished golfer, six-time Western MVP, three-time Ontario University champion, 2019 Ontario Mid Amateur Champion, and this year he was runner-up. I mean, if my podcast had enough time, there are another 50 accolades and awards that he's probably won over his entire life. But for me, he is a friend and someone that I share time and thinking with, and I am proud to have him on my show today. Charles, welcome. It's nice to have you. I thought that it would be great if the two of us spent some time. We've played a couple of golf games together. And one of the things that I found very, very fascinating was, as you talked about your sports psychology business and the people that you coach, sort of elite athletes in a variety of sports. And I talked about the people that I coach in business and as young people, it struck me that there were a lot of similarities in what we were trying to accomplish. I, of course, don't have the educational background that you do. So the people that I'm coaching are unfortunately dealing with a layman trying to figure it out. You have the credentials behind you. So welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Jim. It's an absolute pleasure. And I think your credentials come from your experience in life and all the amazing accomplishments you have that way. So I wouldn't sell yourself too short that way.
Thank you very much. And the check will be in the mail for that. Thank you very much. So maybe we could start so people could get why don't you give us a snapshot of your life? And, you know, you've had a lot of experience, the people you coach, and a sort of broad overall view of what your goal is with these people. Because I think what sort of drove me to this conversation is that I think people think that elite athletes are different in many ways than normal people, right? But, you know, what struck me in our conversation is they all have the same fears, all of the idiosyncrasies. So maybe you could give us a little background on your practice to start with.
Yeah, certainly. Again, I work with a range of athletes from young developing athletes all the way through to professional athletes in a range of sports. Golf and hockey are the main focuses, but I work in a wide, wide range. What we do is we help athletes through coaching in mental skills that are based in sports psychology. So we help them to understand their thoughts and their feelings and how that potentially impacts their performance. And as you said, you know, what we realize is even the best performers have fears and uncertainties. And it's just the same, they're people. They're people like everyone else. And the more we can connect with them and help them to understand something that you've talked about a lot in terms of their strengths and really what makes them great, the more we can help them to develop that sense of confidence and the willingness to take on challenges, especially that fear. Because all of a sudden they realize that one, either they are skilled enough to overcome that fear, or two, that fear isn't as important as they thought in the first place. So really trying to help them work through these different challenges and ultimately help them to find, obviously the biggest goal is enhanced performance, but we also really try and help them find a greater sense of fulfillment.
You know, it's interesting because I think if you surveyed most people, they would think that great athletes are because of their skills. You know, they're gifted and it's Wayne Gretzky or it's, you know, Brooke Henderson or whomever it is, that their life is different because, you know, they're talented, they're driven and all of those types of things. But, you know, people forget that Brooke Henderson, I think, stopped going to regular school from the age of 12 or 13, whatever, right? So there are all kinds of things that she lost in her life. And, you know, if you're doing something every single day, you're going to improve on it. But, you know, you said something in what you were talking about. And I think that people don't quite realize that elite athletes or athletes that are really good have the same fears as everybody else. Maybe you could talk about that kernel of insecurity or that fear that to the layman looking outside, people are looking, what are you afraid of? You're getting a golf ball 400 yards, you know, or this or that, right? How do you help them with that sort of juxtapose that they're dealing with, right?
The biggest way that we look on taking on fear, because honestly, the biggest fear is fear of failure. And this is something that people in all walks of life face. It really doesn't matter what you're doing. Nobody likes to fail. In psychology, there's something called a growth mindset, which is basically saying, and I know this is a big part of your philosophy as well, that failure is not a bad thing. Failure is actually a critical part of success. I think you say not to count your failures, but to succeed, right? It's the idea that if you fail in a pursuit that is in the right direction for you, that's going to help you to grow and develop and get better. And actually, you know, I think back to your book a little bit, a lot of times what people initially think of as a failure actually is a success. I know you've talked about, for example, people turning down the wrong job and they thought, you know, oh, if I don't get the job, that's a failure. But actually it's a success in that you didn't get the job that was wrong for you.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, as I've learned over these years, you know, everything is in a moment. People are, you know, sort of obsessed with the moment. And I think about my own daughter, Sarah, who you coach as well. And when she was the last cut in women's hockey and we were walking out and she was crying and the coach came out and said, really, sweetie, I'm really sorry, but your skating skills just weren't up to speed. Just work on your skating this year and, you know, maybe next year you'll make it. And as a result of that one failure, she completely changed the direction of her life. Because then, you know, we took her to start to play a little golf and a little more golf. And, you know, as you know, and as my listeners know, she's at SMU playing golf down there. But that moment of failure, it wasn't really a failure. It was just a redirection in life.
Yeah. If she had taken that and said, Dad, put me in speed skating and power skating, and I'm going to do this 6 days a week, and I'm going to show that coach how awesome, that would have been one direction. That would have been great. But it shows her that actually, you know what, is this really where I want to be? Is this really what I want to spend my time doing? And I would say for the most part, she's pretty happy with the direction she's gone.
You know, one of the other questions that sort of always arises in my mind is there are so many people that feel this way. I mean, you see it in the athletic world, but you also see it in the non-athletic world because you meet people all the time and everything else. You know, people often say to me, you know, you're so self-assured, you know, and I say, it's because I don't care if I'm right or wrong. I said, it doesn't matter to me. I'm ambivalent to it. I mean, I'd like to be right, but I'm ambivalent to whether I'm right or wrong, because I know if I'm wrong, then I'm going to be able to, I've got more information to figure out the next type of thing. But I often wonder, you know, sort of where this kind of generates. It's a general thing that I see in the population. And as we get into this new world that we're in, where a lot of young people have much of that insecurity, they have much of that, can I really turn down a job? You know, can I really be as great, you know, as the potential is, or I have no idea what it is. Like, what are we not doing as a society for people when they're young and when they're growing up in parenting, right? I've always felt that parenting is a negative reinforcement because 90% of the time you're telling the kid what they're doing wrong as opposed to celebrating the things they're doing right. So I'd love your ideas on that as well.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something I talk a lot about with my athletes because actually human beings from a fundamental starting place are at a disadvantage. We have this bias in our memory towards remembering bad things more easily than good things. And so when we fail a test, that is worse in our brain and therefore more memorable than passing a test or succeeding in a test. As a survival mechanism, this would be really effective. You know, if you eat a berry that makes you sick, you want to remember that so you never eat that berry again, right? But in modern society, it really kind of holds us back and has a huge impact on our confidence. In sport, we talk about this a lot in terms of, for example, in golf, you remember a bad shot that much more easily than a good shot. And so we really have to work really, really hard at helping golfers to remember their good shots to outweigh that natural bias that they have towards remembering the negative. The classic example is a teacher will give somebody a paperback and they'll give them a whole paragraph about what they did wrong. And then what they did right, they gave them a little check mark. And they never give them that reinforcement that you're talking about to say, this is what you did well, this is why you did it well, and this is how you can even get better at it.
Do you think maybe also I've felt like this, and particularly in the financial world that I had been in for so long, that there's a natural human reluctance to overpraise someone. And you know, when I was growing up, you know, my mother would, when someone would put too much praise on me or say too many nice things, you know, she would say, be careful, you know, the evil eye is going to get them because you're saying too many nice things. But I have noticed over my lifetime that people have this reluctance to overpraise someone because they're concerned that it'll go to their head or you know, they'll get full of themselves. And I'm like, full of themselves about things they're doing well? Wow, what a drag that would be.
Yeah. You know? How terrible a world would that be if people actually felt good about their strengths? I do wonder sometimes there is a bit of a cultural component to this. There doesn't seem to be quite as much of a concern in America about pushing people towards their strengths and what they're good at. You know, I do an exercise with athletes and I'll just ask them and say, what are you good at? And Canadian athletes will kind of hum and haw and they won't be sure. And they'll kind of, you know, we have this ingrained humility or humbleness that we can't kind of get over. If you ask most American athletes what they're good at, they start listing things right off. Oh, I'm great at this, great at this, and this is why I'm the best. I think there is a cultural component to it as well, but certainly the idea that, you know, people could get, you know, what is the expression, outside their bridges or whatever it is in terms of they're too full of confidence. Well, obviously, you know, that's led us in a direction where as a society, we have a lot of mental health issues because of a lack of confidence and self-esteem. So I don't know how well that philosophy has really worked out in the long run.
You know, it's, I always call it, it's the I am not worthy syndrome, right? I see it culturally, but I also see it professionally. And I always tell the story about being at a lobster feast and there's two pots and one has an American flag on it and the other has a Canadian flag on it. And the American lobster pot has a lid on it. And so when I inquired of the host, what's the difference? And they said, well, in the American lobster pot, they're American lobsters and the Canadian lobster pot are Canadian lobsters. And I said, yeah, but you have a lid on the American lobster pot. And they said, yeah, it's because when the water starts to boil, the American lobsters will crawl out. And I said, well, aren't you worried about the same thing happening in the Canadian lobster pot? And they said, no, because when one of them tries to get out, the others pull them back down. I was told that story so many years ago. I still tell it a lot of times, and I'm sure I'll get hate mail about, you know, how to generalize Canadians. So getting over that it's okay to fail. Like, I think the terminology you used was, instead of being afraid, harnessing the fear, right? You know, it's almost like walking at the edge to take the next step, right? Like just take the next step. How do you go about that? Like, that's a massive hurdle, right? Because people are sort of like, you're going, just here, give me your hand. Just take the next step. Just try it.
Yeah. Basically what it comes down to is in life, that fear triggers a response that basically says your life is in jeopardy. Even if it's not, you know, if you're afraid of getting fired, your brain interprets that as literally you could die if you do this. And so in sport, what we have to help athletes realize is, in fact, they won't die if they hit a bad golf shot. There's no way to describe it. You have to experience it. And so what I'll do is I'll take athletes to a spot on the golf course where they feel the most fear. And we'll just sit there and we'll force them to hit shots in the most fearful way possible until they realize that it doesn't kill them if they hit one in that water hazard or something like that. So I remember there was a great moment. We were down in South Carolina at Can-Am's. The golf course we play, the seventh hole, is this great little par three. There's water left. And it is just astonishing how many kids hit it left into this water because they feel that fear and it just attracts their attention and boom. So I took a group of kids there and I said, okay, great. Here's some golf balls. You have to aim in the water and you have to try and work it away from the water to the green. All three girls hit the green and one of them almost holed it. And this was with them trying to hit it in the water and feel that fear. When if they aimed at the green, I bet you at least one, maybe two or three of them would have hit it in the water. So they have to go through this experience of realizing when I take on the fear, not only do I not die, but actually I can be really successful. And that's an incredibly empowering experience. And I remember playing with one of the Team Ontario athletes at the Ontario Ontario Amateur this year. And he had some great shots, and he came over and said, "Charles, that was me taking on the fear. That was something we worked on." And obviously, as a coach, that was just
a
moment for me.
Yeah, there's nothing better than when someone, you know, steps up. And I had one of those situations yesterday, a young woman that I coach, who'd been, in my opinion, you know, badly abused by the firm that she works for. And when I was finally able to get her to stand up and challenge the person who supposedly was her mentor and was supposed to take care of her, was doing SFA for her. You know, when she finally took that moment, which was very difficult for her, but she took it, and you know, in a short while, I'd probably say 2 to 3 months, she's now looking at 4 brand new job opportunities, right? And I said to her, "You realize that that's as a result of you taking charge of yourself, right?" You know, one of the things that, you know, I try to emphasize with people, and I know you do, is you have to understand that that responsibility for beating fear and for focus and for discipline, it has to come. And it's scary. I say to people, I get it. It's scary, right? It's scary standing up there looking at the green going, "Fuck, don't put it in the water. Don't," sorry, I'm not supposed to say that. "Don't put it in the water. Don't put it in the water," right? And I often say sometimes when I get up there and someone says, "You know, you don't want to go right," I said, "Don't tell me that. Tell me I don't want to go left," you know? So one of the other things that I often wonder about, because, you know, you coach a lot of women. I coach a lot of women. I have a fairly racially diverse coaching practice as well. You have a fairly racially diverse coaching practice. And not to create a generalization in anything else but that, but how much do you take that into account when you're thinking about the people, right? Obviously, all men and women come from different cultural upbringings. Racially diverse people come from different cultural upbringings. How much do you let that play into, because you can't coach everybody the same, right?
Yeah. No, there's no doubt that you have to start with understanding the person. Obviously, understanding gender and race are a big part of that. We try not to let it define or create preconceived notions. Because, you know, I'm the first person to admit that we all have these implicit biases, right? We have all these unconscious biases that will kind of make us think somebody is a certain way. So I really try, and through my assessment process and through my kind of relationship development process, really try to get to understand the athlete of who they are in the context of their sport, taking into account gender and race, but really focusing just more on who they are, right? And saying, okay, this is what makes this person tick. And from that, we can then look and say, okay, this is what we need to work on. But it's really, really challenging, because we all have our preconceived notions about, you know, this happens or this happens, or these kinds of people look this way, or this gender looks this way and does this kind of thing. So it's difficult sometimes to separate those out, but it's certainly a worthwhile idea. And it's this idea that, you know, if we can really help to say, I understand that I might have a bias one way or another, and this person who I'm talking about has their own bias, right? You know, they might see themselves in a lens where they're never good enough, because, you know, they come from a cultural background where that says, you know, you aren't ever good enough.
And I know exactly, because, you know, I know growing up, you know, I went to the most prestigious investment bank in Canada at the time, Wood Gundy. You couldn't get more waspy. And, you know, I was this little Canadian Albanian boy, and it drove me, right? It defined me, right? It, you know, that weird last name defined me and provided the drive and the fear of failure and the fear of being a fraud, right? Do you find that sometimes in athletes too? I know I find that in my practice. There are a lot of people that often say to me, you know, I feel like I'm a bit of a fraud. Like, I mean, I've had a lot of success and God, you know, like I really don't know if I deserve it type of thing, right? Do you find that with athletes too?
Without a doubt. And there is a huge evidence in research of something called imposter theory, which comes from actors and actresses and CEOs. And it basically says they feel this disconnect of being an imposter, that they haven't really earned it, that they're a fraud. I was just talking with an athlete the other day who's an incredibly successful young lady and has done some really amazing things and has some great strengths. And she basically said, you know, I don't deserve them. It's amazing actually how even the most successful people can have these challenges sometimes. And I think it's important to say, listen, it's okay to have that thought and that doubt, right? But let's talk about it and let's work through and help you understand that, you know, maybe there actually are some things that you're doing well. And it can't be something that I tell them. This is one of the biggest challenges, and something I have to work on a lot with parents of athletes, is the parents will often just go to the athlete and say, well, you know, you're good at this, you're good at this, you're good at this, and they'll just kind of force it into them. And actually, human beings tend to have this idea that we want to know what's best for ourselves. And so a lot of times we'll actually push back on what people tell us. And so if, you know, a parent is telling their kid how great they are, sometimes the kid will push back and be like, well, yeah, but I'm crappy in this way, and I'm crappy in this way, and I'm crappy in this way. And so you have to go through a journey with them to help say, okay, let's think about what you're good at. I'm not going to tell you. You have to go through that reflection journey.
You know, it's interesting. One of the points you were just making is, you know, when you tell people you're really good at this, you're really good at that. I find people are in self-denial, like, and I'm like, no, you're really good at it. Like, this is like, why don't you just say it? Say it. You're really good at it. Well, you know, I am, you know. And then I'm like, what is wrong with people? You know, like I'm paying you a compliment. Just say thank you. Don't diminish it by sort of trying to water it down. Well, no, you know, type of thing. And it's just a phenomenal psychological thing. So one of the other, and I've seen this myself, I saw it in my own life in that, you know, I had an incredibly rapid, successful rise in the financial services industry. I faced the end of the firing gun twice in 24 months. And I don't think I could have been more rock bottom about how I saw myself and how I felt. And I was very thankful that I, through, you know, the support of my wife and a few close friends, not many, most people kind of abandoned the ship at that point, sort of was able to resurrect myself, recreate myself. I don't think recreate, but that's what people would say. I think I'm the same person, but with different focus. How do you deal with athletes that have had, you know, like, I mean, like Jordan Spieth, right? Or, you know, people that basically put on their shoes in the morning and they were great, right? Never thought about it and everything else. And then all of a sudden it vanishes.
It's really, really challenging. And I think you, as a starting point, your point about how quickly, you know, people jump off the bandwagon when things go poorly, it really shows you who's really a friend and a close confidant, the people who really matter in your life, right? When those difficult situations come around. But in terms of dealing with failure, especially when people are naturally talented, that is one of the most challenging things. In psychology, we talk about these two different ways people tend to define themselves. One is called an ego focus and one is called a mastery focus. Ego-focused people tend to learn that they're just better than other people because they're talented. They didn't really have to work at it. And these are people who tend to have a lot of success at a young age. You know, they're a little bigger, they're a little stronger, they're a little faster, they're a little smarter. And so when they face failure, those people then tend to say, well, I guess I'm just not good enough. And they kind of will give up, right? And we have to challenge them to say, listen, no, like you succeeded because of these skills. Yes, you might be talented, but you also put this work in. And so we have to help them look more towards what we call this mastery focus, where it says your goal in life is not to be perfect and to be the best at something compared to other people. It's to be the best that you can be. Greg Norman, who was one of the best golfers in the world, always said, I was never trying to be the number one player in the world. I was just trying to be as good as I could be. And wherever that took me was fine. And he did that based on working on his skills and trying to create this mastery environment. So it's something I try and instill on athletes from a younger age. But certainly there are major challenges with athletes who've had a lot of success at a young age because they're just naturally better, and getting them to shift their way of thinking and their way of defining their self-worth from, you know, what the result on the podium is or on the scoreboard is, to the work that they put in behind the scenes and developing the skills to become as good as they can be.
Sometimes having too much talent is a curse because you don't think you have to work that hard to maintain it. And the constantly stories everywhere of people that weren't that talented, but ended up being more successful, right? Weren't that smart, but ended up getting a higher position in an organization, right? Because they just sheer outworked everybody else, right? Even Bryson DeChambeau, you know, they talk about his success and yet he's at the driving range for 4 hours after the tournament, right?
Yeah. And it's one of the things it became a really a call to action with Team Ontario this year. In golf is to say, to be the best, you have to outwork the best. Somebody like Tiger Woods, who is incredibly talented, also worked the hardest. But you're right that the people who are talented, if they don't learn to work, they're going to get passed by the people who are willing to put in that work, the people who are willing to reflect and learn from their failures and learn from their challenges to grow and keep working on mastering those skills to get as good as they can be. That would be always somebody I would pick because they will always end up not only being more fulfilled with what they're doing, but also working towards a higher level of success kind of in terms of their utilization or their possibilities.
So that's a good spot to end things. And I think that hopefully for all of our listeners, Charles, thank you very, very much for coming and joining me today. I'm looking forward to our next game, either North or South. But I think for my listeners, what I hope you take away from this is that elite athletes or great athletes or just individuals, we all share the same common fears. We all share the same common frustrations. And the only difference, you know, the only change you can make that is positive and successful is the change in yourself. And sometimes just believing in yourself, and even if you don't believe in yourself, allow yourself the fantasy of believing in yourself partially to sort of see what that next step is. You know, as I say in my email, indecision is a killer. Just keep making decisions, keep trying things, believe in yourself, because those that believe in themselves, whether they have talent or hard work, are the ones that at the end of the day are successful. And I don't mean success in the measure of money or titles, but success in happiness in life. And if you're happy with yourself in life, you have happy relationships with other people. Thank you very much, Charles. It was great to have you.
An absolute pleasure.
And everyone, the podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust.